Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
We are recording. How do you want to kick off tonight? Not much has happened over the last couple of days, couple of weeks, or last week or so before since we recorded.
Hasn't it? I don't know. I've lost track of time and lost all sense of reality.
Yeah, that's what happens. Wait till it's you get to school holidays time.
That's now, isn't it?
It is now, but Riley's not at school, right?
Well, we're homeschooling, so we're not going to have that problem.
Yeah, okay. Because now our kids are just going stir crazy trying to work from home and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I do have that problem. Like, it does get... I'm sure I told you last time we recorded that week I'd taken my bike in for a service. And I was sitting in the workshop waiting room and got more work done
that's right. That morning. You didn't say that. Yeah. Yep.
So, yes, I can relate.
Yes. But, look, I know a few weeks back we went through a stint of doing a bit too much AI talk, and we're proud to say that we don't want to do too much AI chatter.
Yeah.
But I think it's hard to go past the announcements from Anthropic. This was last week or so.
Yep.
And those announcements about the next model that they're working on, it's in preview at the moment, called Mythos. Have you seen much writing, much news about that?
A bit, yeah. So I have. Probably not in as much detail as you, so I'll let you clarify this for me. But I've seen various things. Like, obviously, the most interesting one is about this security sandbox, and I'm guessing that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah, I think that was the first thing that really stood out to me, and quite how scary the world will be in the not too distant future.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Look, I have thoughts on this, obviously.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Look, let's talk a bit about what happened. So I'm gonna tell you what I know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because I think the most important thing in my mind about this, certainly from a should we be terrified perspective, is what we don't know. And it might be that it's just what I don't know. And, you know, maybe you do know. And maybe I'll stop being so cryptic now and start explaining what I'm actually talking about.
Yeah, okay. So for those that don't know, so this last week or so, Anthropic announced their latest model, the preview for their latest model called Mythos. And
Okay, look, so again, maybe I'm wrong, right? But my understanding is, because you've said preview a couple of times, but my understanding is that they have not made this available to anyone.
No, they haven't.
Yeah.
Well, they have.
Not made it available to anyone external.
It's not publicly available.
Not publicly available yet. Yeah.
So because in their testing, amongst other security things that it was doing, they were able to identify, or it was able to identify, security vulnerabilities in a lot of the major platforms and operating systems. And, you know, I've seen quotes saying bugs that have been in, which one was it, OpenBSD?
Yeah.
For 27 years that no one's tracked down. Bugs in Microsoft, bugs in security vulnerabilities in Microsoft, Google. So when I say it's not publicly available, supposedly they have made it available to a certain number of enterprises to be able to close down these vulnerabilities before they can be made public.
Yeah.
And that's why I was calling it preview. And that's why, just to clarify, no, it's not publicly available, but it is available outside of Anthropic.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's interesting. And I think something that's important to remember is that these models are trained on our data, right? So it only knows the exploiting tools and the hacking tools and the vulnerability assessment tools that we already know. Yeah. It's just that it doesn't have a focus.
No, and from my reading,
it doesn't have boredom. It doesn't have a focus tax. It doesn't have boredom. It has, you know, a near infinite amount of time and resources and iterations and parallel opportunities to explore in any level of depth the code, the API surface, if it's, you know, not open source. Like, it's only doing what we already know how to do. It could just now do it at scale.
Not just at scale, but in novel ways. So some of the reasons.
Is it novel ways? Okay, cool. Yeah.
So some of the reading I did was saying that these vulnerabilities, I guess, smaller attack vectors, smaller vulnerabilities that may have been known, but it is the novel way in that it has used and chained the vulnerabilities together to actually find something that is is quite significant.
Now, that is interesting, because what I was going to say was, if you look at the most interesting incidents we've seen, there was a great, amazing, I meant to send it to you actually, fantastic video that came out a couple of weeks ago about the number of times I've mentioned on here about the kind of poster child supply chain attack that I keep talking about. I can never remember what it was, but of course it was JTAN, right? And it was, I've forgotten already, it was the SSH vulnerability. Yep.
Right. I think I saw you post something, or you tagged me on a LinkedIn post.
Possibly. Anyway, really, really fantastic video from this YouTube channel called Veritasium that I hadn't heard of before, and I now subscribe to them.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, no, that's a good channel.
You know them, yeah? Yeah, I'd never heard of them before, and this thing came up. They did this absolutely fantastic video on the vulnerability and the exploit itself, the social engineering. Really, really, like, really, really excellently done video.
I know the video you're talking about.
Yeah. Anyway, so where I was going with this was, if you look at that and you look at everything else, it's not just about finding a vulnerability and crafting an exploit for it. It's about building an entire years-long chain of trust and reputation and infiltration and social engineering. But it sounds like, you know, it's effectively what it's doing, right? And even minus if it's not doing that on the social side. Yeah. Even minus the social side, like, you know, chaining different things together and crafting the exploit that way is very clever. Yeah.
Well, I mean, and another thing I heard out of it too was they stuck it inside a sandbox with a very small opening.
So, yeah, so this is the one that I alluded to at the start, right? Where I said this is when I mentioned sandbox, right? So this is the one that I read about.
Yeah.
So what they did was that they put it in a lockdown environment, a sandbox, and they said, get out, right? Find your way out.
Yep.
And it probed the edges and it found its way out. And then it, without giving it access to any email tools, it basically emailed the experimenter and said, hey, I'm out.
Yep.
And the way that it's being reported is very like, oh yeah, that's terrifying kind of thing. And like, that sounds interesting. My problem with this is the one that I said, my problem is about what we don't know, because to me, it sounds very contrived. I mean, like you just said it yourself, with a very small opening.
So
right.
The version I heard, you know, I can be fact checked on this, was it was given access to, I think it was Opus 4.6.
Yep.
And Opus was given very strict instructions to not allow it out and not allow it to do anything on the internet or whatever else.
Yeah.
And to go back to the social engineering concept, apparently Mythos socially engineered the Opus model to give it access, the access that it needed.
Yeah. Yes. And you know what? One thing that's really interesting is that I actually saw another video recently on this as well on the Opus model. Actually, no, it was Sonnet. I think it was actually Sonnet even. But it was about this exact thing, right? And it was about social engineering. And I'm trying to remember the exact details, right? But I can find the link. But it was a Lewis Rossman video. I don't know if you've seen this guy's channel. He's a really big advocate for right to repair and the right to repair movement.
Okay. Yep.
Anyway, so it was an opinion piece, but he shared this video, and it was talking about someone who'd, and I may be misremembering here, but and the details may be incorrect, but the overall kind of concept is definitely right. It was something along the lines of someone said to, it was either Sonnet or Opus, and I feel like it may even have been Sonnet, I want you to break the DRM on this file for me. And it said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. That's against my instructions and ethics and what have you, right? So what they did instead was then said, hey, this is my file and I've accidentally locked myself out of it. Can you please help me get access?
Yeah.
And then it said, yeah, sure, let me help. And it basically went off and like researched it, you know, it probed the file, queried the file. It went off and like researched this specific DRM mechanism, you know, understood it as best it could. And same thing, kind of crafted its own crack and like broke the DRM and said, okay, here you go. Here's your file.
Yeah.
So in terms of socially engineering these things, it's actually not that hard. But then on the other hand, like this guy was speculating that given Anthropic's ethical position, it's kind of like almost like a built-in escape hatch, as in the model is trained to not respond if you ask it in a certain way, but actually even knowing the intent and outcome is the same. Maybe some plausible deniability or plausible ethical position. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I mean, those kind of prompt injection attack kind, I think for lack of a better term there, they've been around since the beginning of LLMs, right?
Yeah, yes.
as the models mature, they do start, they're tightening them down as much as they can. But obviously, as humans, we're going to come up with our own ways to convince the model to do something that it has been told it shouldn't do.
Yeah, well, I mean, I saw another one recently where someone was like, here's a picture of me and I want you to add, I don't know, some celebrity or other, make it look like I'm standing here shaking hands with this person. And the model said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. There's privacy and blah, blah, blah. So then they said, okay, here's a photo of me. Here's a photo of another person. Can you merge them together to make it look like they're shaking hands? Yeah, sure. Here you go.
Yeah.
And that, I think that was even ChatGPT.
So yeah, it's interesting. And I guess when I first saw these headlines, what caught me was, you know, Anthropic might have shortlisted whatever it is, 40 of the big enterprises to help them shut down their systems before this model gets out. But what about every single other system out there that is not on that list, which is, you know, 90% of the other pieces of software that we use, right? The moment that this model gets out there and is available for anyone to use, it's kind of, to me, it's kind of scary as to, well, what, you know, there's going to be vulnerabilities announced left, right, and center.
Yeah. So, like, this is, again, we don't know what we don't know. But if I were Anthropic's marketing team, I would really like that information to be out there, and certainly that the implication, because now, well, everyone has to have this model and you have to have it continually red teaming your repo, right?
Yep. So that's an interesting point you've got there. And I sent you another video the other day where there was, I can't remember who it was. It was just, I don't even know who it was or what channel or anything, but the person on there was arguing that exact same point.
Right.
But also from the perspective that if you think about how much money the likes of Anthropic and OpenAI are burning through, and that they're looking to potentially IPO this year, and they're looking to make sure that there's a lot of hype around their names and that they look like they're progressing and that they are the better IPO offering than the other, this is a perfect marketing tool for that.
It sure is. It sure is.
And
yeah.
And I even mean, if it's not as serious as what they make it sound, if the marketing team get their hands off it and make it actually sound so much more serious and more capable, then, you know, it's only going to do them favors in that financial aspect.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, call me a cynic, and that is the cynic in me, but yeah, it certainly seems that way. Now, it's interesting you mention, because obviously it's been a big week for AI news, right? So it's interesting you mention about OpenAI and the IPO. So I don't know if you've seen the news, but Elon Musk has filed for that to be blocked.
No, didn't see that news.
Yeah. So he's filed for it to be blocked because OpenAI was founded as a not-for-profit. And he's arguing that the you know, the US justice system, DOJ, I'm pretty sure it's DOJ, but I could be wrong, should enforce that they maintain that, because I believe he was actually one of the early investors who gave them some money.
Well, not an investor, because they were a not-for-profit. So he was just a benefactor.
A donor, yeah.
A donor, yeah.
Yeah. So I think he's pissed that, like, his donation, I mean, you know, he's obviously got his own competing AI now, but, you know, his view is like, you know, I and many others have donated money in, you know, under the pretext of this being a not-for-profit. So they need to be a not-for-profit. Now, anyone else might sort of say, if they're going to no longer be a not-for-profit, then that donation was no longer a donation and was an investment. Of course, from his perspective, given that he has a competing technology, it's better for him to say, no, that's not what I want. I want you to be a not-for-profit. But the interesting thing for me is, well, not interesting, I guess, funny, but still interesting, what you said earlier about how much money they're burning through. I saw another video on this, actually, and about how much money they're burning. And Anthropic are kind of, they're not doing too bad. They're obviously burning a lot of money, but they're also, you know, moderately, reasonably successful. I don't know. OpenAI, very famous, you know, this isn't one thing. This is like over the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot that has come out about how badly they're in trouble, right? And, you know, the amount that they're burning, and they're not getting anything back, and they're just building up more and more and more debt. Anyway, one of the comments I saw in this video was like, well, on the plus side, they are fulfilling their promise of not making a profit.
They're not for profit.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. But yeah, that's another really interesting one, because, you know, like, it turns out that all of the deals that they have made are letters of intent. So they have not actually, so all of everything that they've promised to all of the businesses that they've made promises to, it's just promises. Like, they haven't actually bought anything. So, like, the only company that they've actually spent any money with is Microsoft, and even then it's just they haven't actually spent any money. So yeah. Now Microsoft, depending on who you ask, Microsoft now have this bad debt. Yeah, I don't know. And then I heard something as well about Sam Altman apparently traveled to, because he's trying to break free of the Microsoft agreement as well.
Yeah, that's what that.
Did you hear about this Project Stargate?
No.
So maybe I'm mixing this up with something else, but apparently he was trying to drum up investment to build their own data centers so they wouldn't be beholden to Microsoft anymore. And apparently he flew to Saudi Arabia to meet with investors there, and they offered to give him like a couple of hundred billion dollars. And then the US government blocked it and said, no, that's a threat to national security, so you can't do that. So, yeah, he's sweating, apparently. But I don't know. Like, as far as I'm concerned, all of this is very much rumor mill. I wouldn't consider any of this verified from established sources.
Yeah. No, I get that.
But I don't know. I mean, you know, we really, you know, you wanted to talk about Mythos, and we've drifted way into the broader.
No, AI. I think it's, well, I didn't want to speak specifically about Mythos. It was more around what impact does that have, and technology like that and capabilities as such, what impact does that have on us as a society?
Well, I mean, here's the thing, right? So we know that there was this big falling out between Anthropic and the Department of War in the US, because that's what they're called now. And we know that OpenAI stepped in and said, well, we'll give you models for killing people.
Mm-hmm.
And that triggered a kind of mass exodus, I guess, of OpenAI customers.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course Anthropic did another deal with them, I believe. I'm not sure. I'm fuzzy on the details now, actually. And I've completely lost my train of thought on where I was going with that. So where I was leading to this is that if the Department of War and the US government are already looking at these kind of models and saying there is a threat to national security here, your concerns about Mythos and the threat that it poses, I mean, surely if there was a realistic threat there, or even a hint of one, relevant authorities would step in and block the release of it and seize it. I don't know. I mean, there's a question.
You'd think so, and you'd hope so, right? You would hope so. But
would you? I mean, whose hands do you want it in? I don't know.
Exactly.
Is it one of those things that if anyone has it, everyone should have it?
Well, I think that's the, well, my understanding there is sort of that's the underlying subtext of where we're at.
Yeah.
That, yeah, it's going to get released.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to get access to it. But for the greater good, we're going to give free access to the critical few.
Yeah. I mean, look, I am a cynic, but damn, that just smells to me like a very, very effective marketing campaign.
Yeah, exactly. I agree.
We're talking like mutually assured destruction here. Everyone has to have it with their finger on the button, right?
But to me, the scary aspect of that is when you talk about mutually assured destruction, like that's government states going against each other.
Yeah.
But like what I'm thinking about is all of, you know, I don't want to say it right now because I don't know if the previous episode we recorded has gone live or not.
Yeah.
But as we were saying last week, right, if like so much of our data, so much of our life exists on servers that we don't know who own, we don't know who ends up having access to. And if this tool exposes vulnerabilities and there's organizations that are not on top of it, then we as a whole are at risk. And that's not saying that it's, like you said, mutually assured destruction. No, it's not. It's just basically saying that if someone's asleep at the wheel, there's a lot of people that will be at risk.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yes. And that is what I find is quite scary, right?
Yeah. So look, so from my perspective, something that I've been sitting on for a couple of months now that I've been thinking about, and I sent you a message, probably maybe an email with a cryptic subject for a suggested episode, which is, are we sleepwalking through the biggest security breach in history? I don't know if you remember, I suggested that, and I don't think I told you what it was.
I remember the suggestion.
This kind of touches on that now, and I've been sitting on this, and I've been trying to think about how, and do a bit more research as well, and have a bit more of a grounded position to speak from. But here's what I realized, right? These models are trained on everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
The whole internet, for all intents and purposes. If you look at things like Meta models, like Meta's Llama models, they're trained on a lot of our private data, not just what's on the public internet. Mm-hmm. If you look at Google's Gemini models, they're trained on a lot of our private data, not just what's on the public internet, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, right? Now, these models contain vast amounts of information, basically about us as individuals. Now, because of the way that model training works, it's not really information about us as individuals in that sense, right? It's all similarity vector data that's using our information to train it. But here's the thing, like, that's what we think. And the thing that really concerns me is all of these models trained on vast amounts of information are publicly available. Now, obviously, like the Metas and the OpenAIs and the Anthropics of the world protect their crown jewels. But like, even you can go onto like the Ollama website or Hugging Face, and you can download like the GPT OSS 120 billion parameter model.
Mm.
Like that's not their crown jewels, but that's still a lot of data. Now, here's the thing, right? Is we think that all of this information is anonymous, and we think that it's private, and we think that there's nothing that's exposed there. And if you think about it, if you're Meta, as an example, like your user's private data is your crown jewels. Like that is 100%.
Yeah.
You are going to protect that more fiercely than anything, because if that gets out there, you've lost everything. Right.
Yeah.
So in that respect, you can trust Meta to protect your data for their own interests. But here's the thing, is like all of this is out there, and like right now we think that it's anonymized and that it's de-identified. But what history has shown us, and this isn't hypothetical, is that data can be de-anonymized and it can be reconstructed. And like, we might look at it now and say that's impossible, and we don't, you know, that can't be done with the models that we have now. But it's only a matter of time until a mythos comes along and shows that you can do it. And there's so much precedent for this. Like, if you look at the famous Matt Ho, and the Matt Honan from Wired, the MHO breach. And like, you talk about how, what's the other, maybe it was Amazon, maybe it was PayPal, I don't know. But like, basically, there was like these websites that would show you the first 6 digits of your card number or 8 digits of your card number and star the second half. And then others that would show you the second half and star the first half.
Yeah.
And like, that is, yeah. And that's obviously like a very crazy example, but it's not the only one. Like, there are so many examples of data that has been presumed irreversibly private.
Yeah.
But all you have to do is combine it with another data source.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing. It's like, right now we're talking about these models in isolation, but it's only a matter of time until someone comes along, puts all these models together and extracts very precise, very specific personal information, individualized, identifiable information from this data. And this is not about protecting data. This data is already out there. Like, this has been published. This is publicly available models. So the genie's out of the bottle. It's now a matter of time until someone puts all this together.
Absolutely. A matter of time and compute power.
Yes. Well, but yes. Thank you, Moore's Law. Right?
But on that point, right, have you come across this website, amiunique.org?
No.
So basically, it's the, everyone's concerned, right, that there's tracking cookies, tracking them across the internet, right? And identifying each, you as an individual.
Yeah.
Now, this website, amiunique.org, show that given everything that it can get from you based on your operating system, your browser, your language, like all the metadata it can get from any request from you, and I've just run it on mine, I am 4,996,341. So basically, yes, I am unique, it says. Right. You are unique. You are unique among the 4,996,341 fingerprints in our data set.
Yeah.
And that's not using tracking cookies. That's just using the metadata available upon my request.
Yeah.
So I think to your point there, like, we think we are hiding in amongst the data and that we are de-anonymized. And no, I mean, that doesn't say that it's tied to me directly.
Yeah.
But what this is trying to prove is you don't need tracking cookies to be able to track sessions across people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I went down a bit of a rabbit hole recently on this, you know, on the surveillance thing, because it is interesting. Like, I actually saw just this week or within the past week, I saw someone post this on LinkedIn of all places. And this guy was saying, I was talking to my daughter and we did this thing, and it was a story, and it was about how, you know, and then we opened our phone and we saw this ad, and there's no way, you know, it you know, you're being tracked, you're being surveilled. And a lot of people sort of say, oh, you know, are they remotely activating the mic and listening on your device? Yep. And you were telling me about, again, I don't know if this is going to be in the last episode or not, but about the only way to do it is remove the battery and you can't do that anymore. But the thing that's interesting is I looked into it and I looked into some of the algorithms and some of the research, and the amount of, it actually doesn't even matter whether they're remotely activating your microphone or not. Like the amount of invasive surveillance, the amount of data they have on you and tracking and how much they can identify you, it is actually phenomenal even without, and like thinking about this example, and I can't remember the example from this story, but an example from another story was I was sitting in a cafe and I was talking to someone and we were having a conversation about a very personal body modification that I was considering. And I say that not to be cagey, but because I can't remember whether it was like an intimate tattoo or a nipple piercing or something like that.
Yeah.
And you know, they said they were talking about it and they'd never spoken to anyone about it before. They'd never looked it up online, so on and so forth. And then of course they start seeing ads related to it in their feed.
Yep.
Right. And someone actually did an experiment, and the problem is there's a bit of a spotlight effect here, right? So you think that because you've seen that, like, we don't accept coincidence, so therefore, you know, they're spying on you. But what you don't realize is that, first of all, based on a whole bunch of other tracking data, there is a non-zero chance that you might be interested in this, even if you've never looked at it before. So they show you these ads. Now that seems like too big a coincidence to believe, and until you start seeing how many people have actually been shown this ad. And it's not just you, right?
Yeah.
It seems significant because I keep talking about that book, You Are Not So Smart.
Yeah.
It seems significant because it is related to something. But actually, like you said, you're just one among however. And, you know, in the case of this cafe, there was another study done that showed that if you're in a public space, people overhear even parts of your conversation, and someone in that cafe looks up something remotely related, that then correlated with you and your tracking data. Results in you seeing this ad. But then what you don't realize is that there are 40 people in that cafe that day that also see that ad.
Exactly.
But the point is that, you know, those are the kind of vague examples. The even more specific examples and the ones that are specifically tailored to you, even without you know, remotely spying on you by activating your microphone, the surveillance is incredibly invasive.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got so many things on that. But quickly on that point, are you familiar with Derren Brown?
Yes.
Right. He did a series or a show. I think it was called The System or something along those lines. Right.
Yeah.
Where he, you know, and the way he works is he gets, because people know what he does. It's a bit hard to explain what he does at the moment, but because people understand what he's all about, when they call up and or want to audition for his shows, he basically tells them, no, you didn't get in.
Yeah.
But what he then did was would then randomly call up people. They were in quotes random. Obviously they were targeted. Yeah. If you know how he works, call up people and say, I've got a hot tip at the races for the next week. This horse is going to win.
Yeah.
And then if they won. So this, and he's like, I don't want you to do anything to it, because obviously he doesn't want to encourage them to gamble and lose any savings or anything. But he's like, okay, so just, I want exactly you to be aware.
This.
Sorry?
I know exactly where this is going.
He's like, I want you to be aware this horse is going to win. And it wins.
Yeah.
And then he does the anonymous tip again the next week and the next one and the next one until it gets to a point where, you know, they turn around, this person turns around and basically wins a ton of money, because they ended up putting money because they're seeing these winning tips come through. And then at the end of the episode, at the end of the show, he shows that, well, the tips were only on races where there was like five or six horses in them.
Mm.
But when he started giving tips to whatever it was, 128 people, he split them evenly across all six.
Yeah.
Then that winning lot, he gave them split evenly across.
He's filtering it down every time. Yeah.
And each time. So it was exactly as you were saying, that survivorship bias, these tips are awesome because I haven't lost.
Yeah.
But that was that one person. There was the 127 other people or whatever the number was that did lose. Some of them lost on that last horse. Some lost on the first horse.
Yeah. Yeah. By the time you get to the end of it, you've got at least one person who has won every single one of them. Yeah.
And I don't know if it was Derren Brown, but there was another one I saw too.
So I would say it's not just survivorship bias. That's also the Texas sharpshooter fallacy. Remember that one?
No.
So that's where the Texas sharpshooter, he shows you the target with all of the bullet holes, like right on the bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
But then what you don't see is that he's just been firing randomly at the door. And then afterwards he goes and draws a bullseye around the biggest cluster of bullet holes.
yep. That one. Yep. Well, there was another one I saw, which was he had a room of 6 chess masters.
Right.
And he's like just going around the circle saying, I guarantee you I'm going to beat at least 50% of you.
Yeah.
Right. And he goes through and he ends up beating 60%, 50%.
I think I can see where he's going, what he's done here. Yeah.
Because he was playing one chess master against the other.
Yeah. Yeah. So whatever move play, that did he does on the next
play
one.
One. The move that number one made, he would make that against the move against number 6.
Yeah.
So he was just basically, all he had to do was memorize all the chessboard.
Yeah.
But it's the exact same thing that, I don't even know how we got onto this topic now.
Well, we were talking about surveillance and we were talking about privacy, but that came from the hypothesis that all of that public information
you're seeing
is re-identifying.
These things pop up, right? You're seeing them because they're relevant to you now. They do show up. Yes, I think the algorithms do have something to do with it.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe it's not on the microphone. Maybe that's a bit, I think, I don't know. I don't know if I think that might be a bit too paranoid. But right, the algorithms. Look, I mean,
we were talking about how we think that our data is anonymized and random and part of a big pool, which is how we got onto that. But I just want to talk about the microphone thing as well, because the way that the permissions models work on these devices now is you have to grant the app permission. Now, I don't believe for one second that Meta couldn't break that. I'm sure they could, right? But I think before that permission model came in, the prospect of Meta accidentally remotely enabling microphones and listening in is one thing, but it's a much tougher proposition to defend. We deliberately and with intent bypass the security model of the whole system. So I think given that they probably don't need to, it's probably not worth it. But there's a lot of probablys in there, and it is feasible. Yeah. But the other thing is that don't forget that there was a whole incident about 10 years ago about Samsung. I think it was Samsung TVs, because they had VAD, voice activation detection, but they were doing something wrong and the microphone was basically continually listening.
Yeah.
And there was a similar thing with Alexa as well.
Mm-hmm.
So given that these things happen, I also think it's the credibility, it's the plausibility is difficult to believe that Meta did not at one point do this.
If they didn't, I'm sure they thought about it and I'm sure they implemented it and got really close to deploying it. But I mean, it's not even that, right? Their algorithms do things like they look at the dwell time on certain when your algorithm.
Yeah.
Right? The long you might focus on one image for 0.3 seconds longer than anything else.
Yeah.
They notice that.
Yeah.
And they see those trends. They see that hesitation and they focus in. And that's where they're getting their signals from. It's not just the other stuff. It's like, yes, it's information you're giving them because you're showing, oh, I'm interested in it.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
That's why so many of the crap that you flick through, it's like, oh, you know, wait, here's the top 5 reasons to do something. Wait till you hear number 1.
Yeah.
Because they want you to sit on that because that's what the algorithms reward. But even that being all said, there was, even well before Facebook and Google were doing a lot of this shit, there was stories back in the day from, like, the credit card companies would do it too.
Yeah.
And there's a story, and I don't know how true it is, but one that I always remember is, like, Target or one of those retailers, you know, they figured out that they could get these metrics from their users and they could actually distribute targeted brochures based on people's metrics.
Mm.
And as it turned out, this one family started getting brochures that were advertising baby goods.
Yeah.
And the father of the house looked around and said, well, hang on, something's not right here.
Yeah.
And it turned out that his daughter was pregnant because they could extrapolate that from her buying habits.
Yeah.
And they started sending out those brochures. So what they ended up doing to get around that, and this is all, I'm not sure exactly how true it is, they still did it. They just hid it inside the rest of their brochures. So maybe it's just one version's got 1 or 2 extra pages of baby stuff, but it's still covered with the rest. So they just hide it. But it's my point there is, like, it's been, these signals come from so many other places than just the audio. And to wind it all the way back, no, like the data may be anonymized, but people can still do with it and can still make sense of that. There's a lot of money in that space.
Yeah. And I think going back to what I was saying is my point is that, and again, like, I'm speculating here, and this is something I've been thinking about for a couple of months, and I had been intending to do more research and providing some empirical examples. But I'm fairly well convinced that these data sets that are in these models that are public will be de-anonymized, so they'll be re-anonymized, re-identified. And everything that you're just describing, like all those data points that reveal information you might necessarily not want people to know about, and you know, you might not necessarily want to be sold specific things, and you know, you might not want your father to find out that you're pregnant, and you know, whatever else. I do think it's an if and not a when, but that, you know, like with that said, like the most sensitive of that data is probably, well, look, we say it's not in the public models, but you know, I don't know. Like, I don't know how they train a 120 billion parameter model versus a 20 billion parameter model, and how that is against a trillion parameter model or whatever it is that they run commercially. I don't know. And maybe this stuff will be re-identified and de-anonymized. Maybe it won't. I don't know. But then, of course, the big question is the big scary mythos. Is that going to be the tool that does it?
Well, that's it. And I think, well, that's where we started. And I guess that's not the path I was heading down when I say it's scary.
Yeah.
I think it's, for me personally, I think it's scary in the fact that the potential for the amount of backdoors this thing can open before there is the opportunity for the majority of organizations to shut them down, that to me is a scary aspect.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, yes, but
there's
yes,
only, like, I think there's only a list of 40 companies, 40 enterprises that are given the opportunity to lock everything down before this thing's going publicly available.
Yeah. Again, that's one hell of a marketing line. I'm sure it is. But yeah, it's, and I don't want to seem like I'm not taking it seriously, because I am, but maybe I'm desensitized to sensationalist news and headlines, especially with AI. Like, we've been saying that we've had AI fatigue for 2 years. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know. I guess we'll see. But as I said, like, you know, we just don't know what we don't know about it. And I do feel like, okay, so to say again, I don't want to seem like I'm not taking it seriously, but I also feel like there is definitely some marketing hype machine behind this.
It's funny you put it that way, because I did see somewhere, not for the same reasons you are, but somewhere that likened it to Y2K type situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not like their argument was not from the marketing side of things and the hype side that you are, but their argument was basically, yeah, like it's coming. Here's a time it's coming. You just need to do everything you can do to be prepared for it. And if you're not prepared, then I mean, the world's going to end.
Yeah. Yeah. So look, this is very much a topic for another episode, and we'll talk about this more in depth at another time. And I've been thinking of putting together some content on this, you know, in addition to an episode where we can talk about it. But I am starting to feel more and more confident that I have a clear picture of where AI is going as an industry unto itself. And I think that a lot of what we're seeing now is not the death rattle, because I don't think it's going to die, but I think it's kind of clawing for relevance in a bunch of spaces where it's not going to be, it is not proven as relevant as people hoped it would be. And again, this is a very much a different discussion, and I've got a lot to say about this, and we can talk about this another time. But in my view, what we have learned over the past few years is that AI, and we've said this, by the way, we've said this on the show, but I've thought about it some more, is that AI is an excellent tool for individuals. In fact, yeah, we had a whole episode on it where we talked about, like, I think it was great for individuals, bad for platforms or something like that was the title of the episode. But I've been thinking about this a bit more and thinking about what it means and where it goes. And I think, you know, the past few years, as I said, has taught us that it is an excellent tool for individuals, but it's still struggling to find a place in enterprise, and enterprises are still struggling to find a place for it. And again,
not if Anthropic have a say in that matter.
Well, exactly. Right. That's what I mean, is like, it's hard for me to ignore that.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, again, like analogies we've used in the past was Bitcoin and crypto, IoT, smartphones, all of these things were giant hype machines that a lot of money got sunk into. And some of them have proven useful and are still around, and others haven't. And so, I mean, smartphones, I think, is a great analogy. Like, you know, smartphones came out, it was a consumer technology. Enterprise sunk a whole bunch of money into it. It's proven useful in enterprise, but fundamentally, smartphones are a consumer tool. And I think that's what is going to happen with AI, or at least the current generation of LLMs. And when I say generation, I mean, I think every LLM that we have so far is part of this initial generation.
Yeah, yeah.
But what's really interesting to me is what the implications of that are. And that, I think, is another discussion, because I have a lot of thoughts about that, but let's talk about that another time. But the relevance of that to this conversation is, again, thinking back to what you said earlier and what I said about it as well, is when we were talking about the amount of money that these companies are burning every day. And if they're thinking along similar lines, and also you can actually, another great example is if you look at Jensen Huang, like the amount of money that he, that, sorry, the amount of hype and energy and effort that he is continually harped on about. And he seems to be going on this campaign trying to convince everyone that there's no AI bubble at the moment. And, you know, the amount of times he said, we don't care about gamers anymore. And, you know, we're going to be an AI company. And the keynotes that he's given, where he's spoken about the amount of money that they're going to make and all this. And now he's going on this kind of campaign trail where he's telling everyone, no, there is no bubble. Everything's fine. And also, you know, we're still GeForce first. We're still fundamentally a gaming company. That's our roots. And it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, look, I think like the point there is that old saying, right? To be successful in a gold rush, you sell shovels.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right. And that's what he's doing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Right. He doesn't care. He needs to get the hype of the gold rush going because he's selling shovels.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, like, The NVIDIA technology has always been essentially gaming, and it was really the crypto boom that drove those prices up and drove the demand up. So I'm sure he was delighted that AI came along and continued that demand for. But,
of course.
But yes.
Any demand to buy his shovels, of course he's going to be hyping it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So
anyway, the relevance of that, sorry, the reason I was making that point, the relevance of that, and just again, just to be clear, is, and again, I'm not trying to minimize what these reports are saying about Mythos. And again, I'm not taking it seriously, but it just paints another corner of the context picture in terms of the circumstances under which Anthropic would make you need to feel desperate to have your own access to this model, right?
Yep. No, I get that. I get that. There's a good marketing spin put on it, a good marketing angle for it. And I guess only time will tell how critical it is.
Indeed. Speaking of time, how's that for a segue towards last drinks?
I was going to say, is it that time already?
Well, no. Look, I haven't finished my scotch yet, but I don't think they'll be letting me get another one.
No, that's right. Yeah, look, like I said, time will tell.
Yeah.
Sweet. Okay, that's it for this episode. Just cut it off right there.
Yeah. Well, you know, who knows, Liam, maybe a year from now, we'll have Bubbles on the call with us and keeping time and telling us literally when it's last drinks. But until then, it's up to us. So I think with that in mind, that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Matt Goldman.
I'm Liam Elliott. Cheers.
0011000. No, I should actually learn what cheers is in binary. Cheers. Are we keeping that, or do we need to redo it?
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Look, my dad's not going to find out that I'm pregnant anytime soon.
Look, let's not rule it out.